Welcome to the South Carolina Lead, a podcast that breaks down state political news for you and provides insight on legislative happenings under the Statehouse Dome in Columbia. Hello, I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode is for the week of June 6, 2018. And we dropped the podcast late this week since the last two gubernatorial debates were held on Monday and Tuesday, and we wanted to make sure we could provide you with a full recap of the action we saw on stage in Columbia. This podcast comes inside of a week until primary day on Tuesday, so get ready, folks. The Lead is a podcast where we go beyond the headlines with the reporters who wrote the stories affecting you. Every Tuesday, we give you a roundup of news, insight into the week's biggest stories, campaign trail intrigue, and a chaser of trivia. You can listen to all four sections of our podcast while you wonder how much longer till the end of Spoleto. Seriously, is it going to end soon? Or while you wait for summer vacation to kick in. Just kidding, we're adults, we don't have summer vacation. But just so you guys know, we will be on sabbatical from July to August, so sorry not sorry there. Now for Quorum Call. Quorum Call is a term to see if there's a majority present, but here on the South Carolina Lead, we know a majority of the time that you're not always current with the news. So here's a quick recap of the several top stories you should know about. And since our discussion runs long today, I've condensed the campaign trail also into the Quorum Call this week. So number one, Columbia Republican Senator John Corson pleaded guilty to misconduct in office Monday and resigned his Senate seat of 33 years. The Post and Courier reports that he will face no time behind bars, but could see up to 10 years if he fails to cooperate with the ongoing Statehouse corruption investigation. He is the fourth Republican legislator to resign and plead guilty as part of the five-year investigation. He has not been asked to pay back any of the $160,000 in campaign money he received from his political consultants, Richard Quinn and Associates. Filing for the District 20 seat opens June 22nd through June 30th, and primaries will be in August, while voters will cast ballots in the November 6th election for the seat. Number two, Republican gubernatorial candidate John Warren announced last week that Pat McKinney is his running mate. McKinney, a real estate developer, was a big supporter of former Governor Nikki Haley's and became one of her appointees to the State Ports Authority. Warren became the third Republican out of the five to announce a running mate. All three Democratic candidates have running mates. Number three, we got to look at the money race heading into the primaries. Democratic gubernatorial candidate Representative James Smith has more money in his campaign war chest than Charleston businessman Phil Noble and Florence attorney Marguerite Willis, according to the Post and Courier, citing campaign disclosures filed with the State Ethics Commission. He has about $456,000 left after raising around $1 million. Now on the Republican side, Catherine Templeton has $1 million left over in her account after raising $3.6 million. Also, Governor Henry McMaster has around $770,000 after raising $4.4 million during this race. Both McMaster and Templeton have spent at least $1 million on TV advertising. And number four, with all that money for messaging and campaigning, a recent poll found both the Republican and Democratic gubernatorial primary races will head into runoffs. The Post and Courier reports that a survey of 400 Republican voters by Michigan-based firm Target Insight found McMaster at 37%. He does not have the majority needed to avoid a runoff between either Templeton or John Warren. Now, the firm didn't release a Democratic poll because it said nearly half of the voters that they surveyed were undecided or unaware of the candidates. Now, if a candidate does not win 50% plus one vote outright, then the two top vote-getters will square off on a June 26th runoff primaries. Now, remember to go vote on Tuesday, June 12th. You can find out everything you need to know about the elections at scvotes.org. And look at that. We let democracy bury the lead this week. Well, we are inside of a week until the June 12th primary. We just wrapped up the final two gubernatorial debates this week, and some voters have cast absentee ballots already based on those debate performances. On Monday, we saw the Democrats jump on their frontrunner, Columbia Representative James Smith, and on Tuesday, we saw a more heated Republican debate with the candidates also piling on the frontrunner, this time incumbent Governor Henry McMaster. To break down all of this, I'm joined this week with two of the debate's co-moderators, Andy Shane and Shauna Adcox. the Bureau Chief and Assistant Bureau Chief for the Post and Courier's Columbia Bureau. Thanks for joining me, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with the Democrats. They started first this week, so we're going to jump try and remember what they did this week. I know Monday was forever away after watching that Republican debate last night. Andy, you were one of the moderators for this debate. With the candidates were on stage, we had businessman Phil Noble, Columbia Representative James Smith, and Florence attorney Marguerite Willis debating. What did you see come out of that debate? What was one of the main takeaways for you after that?
You know, Smith was in the center, on the stage, which, you know, was a good metaphor for the campaign. They've been targeting him all along, so he was the target pretty much all day on Monday night. They're trying to have to bring him back into the fold. I mean, he's got all the money. He's been able to go up on TV. He has got a sort of statewide campaign and apparatus, so he's going to be able to get out the vote. So anything they can do to ding him is maybe a way of bringing him back, maybe under that 50% plus one, to get him into a runoff and to see what happens from there.
Did they ding him enough to do that?
I don't really think so. I mean, they tried, and he has answers. And, you know, this is a man who's been in the state house for two decades and has, as he also said, dodged real bullets, having served a combat tour in Afghanistan. So I think he withstood it pretty well. But I do think he's got an ID issue that he's got to get over, and trying to just assure that he can, again, win that primary outright. Obviously we'll see if that turns around in the last week.
Yeah, and just from what we're seeing, I mean, we've seen Jane Smith at the state house level, worked with him. Then you see these other people across the state are seeing all three of these candidates, sometimes for the first time. How would you say maybe his persona, his platform maybe stands away from or stands apart from those other contenders on stage who are also giving pretty solid answers like Marguerite Willis and Phil Noble?
They're very similar. I mean, just like the Republicans, I think they're fairly similar on the issues. And also just like the Republicans, you have Noble and Willis who are first-time candidates who are trying to sort of say, I would be a breath of fresh air in Columbia, whereas James has been there for two decades. Look how far we've gotten, or the issues that we haven't gotten over, and I'm the one who can fix him.
Yeah, well, and James is running on, I'm the one with experience. I know how to work with people. Phil Noble is running on, I don't want to work with people. I want to blow everything up. So it's a different tactic for sure.
And then Marguerite is?
She's running on being a woman and her girl power, as she says.
Mm-hmm. And her, and I have business experience and legal experience and all that, but that too. But it's not quite as revolutionary, I think, as sort mm-hmm. of, I think we've kind of all sort of seen Noble as kind of like the Bernie Sanders mm-hmm. of this race.
You know, you had Noble saying, if you want more of the same, like the folks who gave you what we've got, talking about Smith 22 years in the legislature and Willis as a corporate lawyer. Sean, you were reporting that story on Monday night for the Post and Courier. Were we seeing Willis, you just mentioned this, talking about her girl power stance, and you focused on that in your story. Were we seeing her use that more this time around compared to the first debate, kind of trying to get that woman's vote? Is that even as much of a factor in this race as what we're seeing as it is in other places?
I definitely think she's running on that. And she, even on the question on, you know, how do you identify with minority voters, her answer was, well, many of our minority voters are African-American women, and I'm a woman. Mm-hmm. And she says that the reason why she joined the race to begin with was because Trump made her feel devalued as a woman, and she wants to counteract that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she definitely.
I thought that was interesting that she, as I said, went with gender, not with race. And the question was a race question. The question was sort of, you know, your three white candidates, how do you identify with the obstacles and the issues that are involving minorities in our state? And to a certain degree, I thought James kind of answered that. James, you know, Noble kind of always goes back to his civil rights background. His father was a minister in Alabama who in the middle of the civil rights movement. So I think it's going to be interesting considering that the Democrats are dominated by it's the dominant party, excuse me, of African-Americans, of minorities in the state, how they'll react to these candidates.
Mm-hmm. But then, you know, you go from that aspect where you're talking about race to maybe a little bit of a tone deafness situation when she talked about sea level rising and how she could tell that from her beach house, whereas, you know, people like Phil Noble said he could tell climate change is affecting downtown Charleston because that's where he lives. Do some of those things maybe set her back, or does that kind of check people? I mean, when you're looking at the Democratic debate versus maybe a Republican debate, when you're looking at the demographics of Democrats?
I think that was an interesting way for her to answer that question. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that helped her. That combined with her original answer in terms of, I've made a lot of money representing big business, was like, whoa, I'm not sure that sells well to Democrats either.
I think it's and I'm not really sure. You know, one of the things we noticed in the last campaign filing that covered essentially the months of April and May, she only raised $40,000, and she didn't take out any more loans or put any more of her own money in it. She's obviously fairly well to do as an attorney, as an antitrust attorney, especially. And I think we kind of expected in a way that she would put more money in the campaign, like John Warren has on the Republican side, to do that. So it makes me wonder, beyond obviously the debates and some of the stump speeches she's doing, how hard is she fighting this? Her ads also had disappeared from air for a couple of weeks, and now only have come back on. And again, I hate to say it, a lot of decisions are made by maybe how often you see ads during the news and during Wheel of Fortune and Jeopardy.
Mm-hmm. And then Andy, you were up there on stage with Charles Beerbauer, who was moderating along with South Carolina Public Radio's Victoria Hansen, who's also asking questions. And it seemed like the most heated part of the night was when Charles asked questions about Corson, Senator John Corson, who was just resigned from office, pled guilty for that ongoing, being part of that ongoing corruption investigation in the State House, along with Representative Rick Quinn. Both of their names were mentioned being tied with James Smith, who worked with those guys up at the State House. Kind of give me a little understanding about what happened when they tried to jump on James Smith about his ties to those two figures at the State House.
Sure. John Corson actually had pled guilty that morning, so it was very top of mind because it had happened several hours before the debate. James, you're a Democrat in the State House. You're at the minority party. You're going to have to want to get along with the Republicans. And, of course, there was also a group of politicians from Richland, Lexington County who tended to hang around each other no matter what party they were. James's background is the fact that he has been the campaign attorney for Republican Attorney General Alan Wilson. He has also won work with the Attorney General's office as an attorney. He's an attorney in Columbia. They brought that up as a criticism. And while he has not done any direct work with Richard Quinn and his firm, again, he's friendly with Rick. Sort of said that there's nothing wrong with being friends with people, mm-hmm. And obviously was trying to separate himself a little bit from that one side of Rick that as folks may know, Republican Representative Rick Quinn was indicted and ended up resigning after pleading guilty late last year. So it's an easy mark to kind of get at James. And again, you can sort of see it from two ways. Is he a guy who looks at things and trying to be bipartisan, try to get things done for the Democratic Party when they're the minority party and it's hard to get things done? Or is it politically convenient and just, you make friends and sometimes your friends make bad choices?
He deflected well, though. And he was clearly anticipating that because, he got a laugh line, mm-hmm. when he said, well, I'll just wait until both of them attack me, essentially.
Yeah.
And then he got applause for his comments on, well, I'm just a good lawyer and you got to get along.
Yeah, and he even said, the party is Democrats aren't supposed to be the party of dishonest personal political attacks. I didn't run to attack my opponents. Ran to attack the problems faced by South Carolinians. Like you said, that got huge applause. He kind of got above it, and it seems like that's what he's been doing the entire time during this debate and this entire race.
You can say above it or deflecting it.
Yeah.
And again, when we start talking about the Republicans, I think we'll talk a little bit again how Henry McMaster, mm-hmm. who's the target of similar attacks, also deflected a lot of it as well instead of answering it directly. But again, it's out, the record is out there on James, and you can judge him on that issue. But in the end, he's a former minority leader in the House. He's considered one of the leading Democrats in the state, and a lot of folks support him because he's got the endorsement of Joe Biden. He's got the endorsement of Jim Clyburn, and he's sort of seen as posing the most serious threat to a Republican in November.
And just kind of wrapping up with the Democrats here, and we're going to jump into the Republicans really quick. But do you guys have any thoughts about what we might see happen next Tuesday for the Democratic side of this primary?
Well, I would expect a runoff.
I think there could be a runoff. Again, if James can get his get-out-the-vote program going, as, again, they have the say-what operation, he might be able to sneak over the line. It's just, again, do people know who James is?
Yeah, I think we all assume that, everyone knows James Smith because we have worked, covered the State House.
Yeah.
But outside of Columbia, he really isn't.
And with recent polling showing that a lot of Democrats apparently don't know, are undecided or don't know who's in the race, the majority of them don't know, could be a little troublesome for trying to get a majority needed to get out of a primary.
And I think it's safe to say that I think our understanding is that Marguerite would probably be most likely the person he would be running against. But mm-hmm. And I would think one-on-one he ends up becoming the Democratic nominee.
And then jumping to the Republicans, Shauna, you were part of the panel last night. Andy was writing the story for the Post and Courier. There was the Lieutenant Governor Kevin Bryant, former Lieutenant Governor Yancey McGill, Governor Henry McMaster, Catherine Templeton, and John Warren, all on stage, like Andy Shane said, was very warm in there at USC. It's because the USC, I mean, there's, we had like 400 people in there, you know, it's going to happen.
Well, it's funny. I got a call from an official from USC this morning, sort of busting me a little bit about making fun about that. But I also mentioned that basically your future governor got to see the deferred maintenance needs needed at the flagship university.
That's what we're talking about. You got to get that AC replaced. But going back to what we're just talking about, when you look at how Smith answered that question with the Quinns and Corson being indicted, resigning, pled guilty, dealing with corruption, and how he kind of deflected and worked with it. What did we see McMaster do when they came after him for that question? I mean, this is something that we shouldn't have been surprising for McMaster to have these Republicans jump on him for, Andy.
You know, it's been the theme of the campaign, corruption, corruption, corruption. I thought that was a good question last night about, well, what do you mean by corruption? And, of course, that led to a good exchange with everyone, though it did get a little personal. And, again, one thing I was interested about last night and is that, for those who have not been following the race, Henry McMaster is going to have one seat in the runoff. He's not going to get 50%, but pretty much guaranteed one seat. So there's only one chair left in this game of musical chairs between Templeton and Warren. And what I've been waiting for is more of from the debates. They've been doing it in ads, but it's going a little bit at each other, saying the reason why you need to put me in the second chair with Henry is X. They didn't do that last night. Henry was in the middle, just like James was in the middle, and Henry seemed to get everything thrown at him. And I thought it was interesting because I was thinking to myself that maybe as a voter, do I really know a distinction between Warren and Templeton? They're both painting themselves as outsiders. They're both painting themselves as folks who are going to fix Columbia and end the status quo. And they both, you know, accuse Henry of being a crony of the Quinn Empire, as they call it. And for those who don't know, what we're talking about is Richard Quinn, who is a very influential, powerful political consultant, was a target of the State House corruption probe. He had been Henry's political consultant for decades. And even though Henry's not been named in the investigation, not been charged in the investigation, and in this campaign is no longer with Richard, they've continued to pick on him about that. Mm. So that's, you know, again, that ended up being a major theme of the night. And in the end,
which he should have expected.
Which I think he did. And he had answers. But again, his answers were, just like James, were deflective.
Mm-hmm. He went on to say that real corruption is Catherine Templeton's no-bid contracts, instead of directly answering a lot of what he was getting.
And mentioning how Warren and Templeton both haven't really given full disclosure of their taxes, too. I mean, that was something he's been doing. Andy, what you're kind of saying about Warren and Templeton fighting it out and how there really is limited differentiation between the two, is that when name recognition is going to be major? Because she's been on the scene longer, running this campaign longer. Warren kind of jumped in here. He's throwing all of his money into this race to get on air.
He's got the momentum. I mean, mm-hmm. and I've likened this, if anyone's been to a horse track or watched the Kentucky Derby, always watch that horse that comes around that last corner and might be in fifth place, zooming fast. Yeah, that's very much where
we
are.
2010 was case in point.
Yeah.
You look at this. Shauna was some great. Wait, you talking about the Derby?
No, not the Derby.
I thought case in point was the name of a horse.
No, the name of that horse was Nikki Haley.
Right. Well, she was last place and all of a sudden surged ahead and went in the last month or so, really.
Yeah,
exactly. And Warren was at 1% in April, and according to the poll from Target Insight. And now he's at 20%, basically in a virtual tie with Templeton for second. And some of the internal polls, multiple polls I have been discussing with folks, Warren is either tied or ahead of her. So he's got the momentum. Now, she's trying to bring him back with a number of ads saying he's not conservative enough. It's not that he's total opposite of where they are, but it's just he's not there on being pro-life. He's not there on being pro-gun.
Yeah.
And he took money from someone who apparently runs a progressive, you know, PAC. So she's trying to bring him back by saying his conservative credentials aren't what you think they are. He's trying to do the same with her. I think in the end, that kind of parsing, might win you a few votes here and there, but I think for the most part,
turn them off.
Exactly. I mean, I agree. It'll turn them off.
Yeah.
Well, and attacking, I'm not sure it's a good tactic to attack a Marine for being anti-gun. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make sense.
And she really tried to like downplay that last night, where she's like, I really respect your service. I understand. You know, I'm not being disingenuous, but you know, he wasn't on board with that. What that silencer bill that Representative Jeff Duncan was pushing. And that was kind of like we're talking about those little different
nuances. Yeah. I mean, these are I mean, this is like sitting here and saying, you know, do you like, you know, margarine, one kind of margarine or another? I mean, it's I'm not really quite sure what you're going to drive with that. And I think there are other issues that they may differ on. But as I wrote today, you know, in a campaign where they differ a little on the issues, you're going to get down to integrity. You're going to get down to these little fights. And, you know, I'm not sure what voters are going to make of it. And the other thing is the big distraction of the night, which was this revelation that Henry said that Catherine wanted to be his running mate, which came out of left field. Now, apparently Catherine's been saying on the campaign trail that the McMaster campaign called her and soon after Trump's election about maybe being a running mate for Henry if he runs for governor. And by the way, at that point, Nikki Haley hadn't left office. She was still in office. So people were figuring that Nikki Haley was going to get a job in the administration. So Henry was going to get promoted from lieutenant governor and thus sort of open the door for a pretty competitive 2018 race. But all of a sudden, to throw this out at a debate, I've been trying to wrestle a little bit who won, who lost. And in the end, I really think the voters ended up losing because we ended up devoting a lot of time to figuring this thing out that actually a lot of it happened off stage.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So Henry brings it up. Catherine doesn't really refute it, doesn't really acknowledge it. But then afterwards, her camp is like all in, talking to us, giving us their version of what happened. And in the end, we're not talking about other things that happened on the stage. And I think it really ended up helping Warren in a way, because in the end, you have these two people bickering over here and John Warren looked like he was above it.
And that kind of comes down to like a little bit more of the insider aspect of this debate. You know, we find that stuff interesting. A lot of people in that crowd probably found it interesting, but the voters who are watching at home were saying, okay, well, I guess that, you know, maybe that kind of shoots down a little bit of her wanting to be an outsider, you know, kind of credentials by saying she wants to partner with an insider and be a running mate. I mean, I guess maybe that's what he was trying to allude to and trying to bring her down a notch by doing that. But if that worked, I don't really know.
Well, and she got a good laugh line when mimicking Henry.
Fair enough.
Yeah, right.
There was a second meeting. There was a meeting when they did finally meet. She asked if he was running for governor. When she learned he was running for governor, she said, I'm running for governor. And he said, fair enough. And that was sort of ended the meeting. And, you know, to give Gibbs Knotts at the College of Charleston a shout out, I agreed with his an assessment he made this morning that I thought Templeton kind of hurt herself a little bit as part of this outsider when she told this whole story about working at the State Ports Authority, a job that she was fired after 5 weeks because, depending on who you believe, her version is that she dared to question contracts from Richard Quinn and bring that up as an issue versus what the Ports Authority said was that basically she wasn't a fit for the job and wasn't really good at what she was doing, and we decided it was time for her to go. But again, it reminded people that she has worked at four state agencies, ran two of them. You know, she had a $250,000 a year job at one of them. You know, again, that's kind of that. I thought that was kind of like the beach house comment of the Republican debate. And I wondered if that kind of backfired on her. And in a weird sort of way, when Henry brought up the no bid contracts, and this is they constantly talk about that. And the background on that is when Catherine was the director at the Department of Health and Environmental Control, she got a consulting contract during the transition time, which was the norm for the agency. It was not unusual because, again, as she put it, I was part of the transition team. Yeah. You know, I still needed to take care of some things. The DHEC director is in charge of a lot of some vital things. But again, what did it remind voters? I'm not so much of an outsider as you think I am.
Exactly. But speaking of switching gears a little bit, we did see John Warren really jabbing McMaster pretty good last night. And he was really playing up that outsider role by saying, quote, I'm a rookie when it comes to government, but I'm not a rookie when it comes to business and leading people in combat, quote. So he was definitely staying on brand all night like he's always been doing and hammering that fact. And he also got after Henry over the Wando River Bridge situation, said, you know, fixing one bridge, that's what you're bragging about. I mean, he really seemed like he checked Henry on that.
Yeah, he got a good zinger on Henry on that one. But he was actually wrong in saying that what we need is a 5-year strategy because the DOT has a 10-year strategy.
It's online.
Yeah, I found that. Yeah, and again, I think we kind of in our fact check kind of said it was a rookie mistake. You know what I mean? The idea that he didn't realize that. And again, I think there's going to be a learning curve. If John does end up winning the election, he's going to have a bit of a learning curve on state government.
But it played well on TV. Voters who don't know the difference thought, wow. That was a good response.
And again, I think he came away from this fray looking, you know, while there was, I think, a lot more fighting between the governor and Catherine Templeton, and then there was also a good sort of back and forth between the lieutenant governor and the governor as well, that he again looked like he was above it, and it'd be interesting to see how that plays out Tuesday.
Well, yeah, and then just wrapping up here, I know we've been talking for a good bit, but Kevin Bryant really did, again, answer a lot of the questions. He got some good praise from some political scientists in the state newspaper who were there to observe and comment on the performances of those candidates. And he, you know, again, he's led the debate on personhood. He led the debate on the constitutional carry bill, wants to fund Planned Parenthood, which he got McMaster to back as well. Does Bryant get any traction, or where does Kevin Bryant go? I mean, he's very well spoken. He executes his message well on stage, but we're a week away. He's been kind of in the single digits in polls. What do you think, Shona?
He's right. I mean, in terms of him being the one to sponsor those bills and him being very on the right all along. But I don't know that he gets traction because he doesn't have any money. He doesn't, kind of like James Smith. We know him in the State House, but people outside of Anderson don't know who he is.
The other issue is that essentially that John Warren sort of also, I think, takes a little bit of his lane as well as sort of the conservative. I'm very focused on some of these very fiscal issues, these social conservative issues. So I wonder even if he did have the money, whether basically they kind of cancel, they would cancel each other out. But I did have a political operative text me yesterday and who said essentially it would be very interesting, how this race would be interesting if Kevin had the kind of money, the $3-4 million that McMaster, Templeton, Warren each have poured into this to see how he would
do. Then it would be a debate on whether experience is a good or bad thing.
Yeah.
And really quick, we're wrapped up here. What do we see on next Tuesday with these Republicans? Runoff?
Oh, absolutely, a runoff.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Do we know who it's going to be?
Well, it'll obviously be McMaster against someone. It'll be that horse race to the end.
Yeah, it's going to be McMaster, and I guess at the moment, just because Warren's got the momentum going, I think it'll be Warren, but I think it'll be neck and neck, and may even be a recount. Who knows on that? Because I wonder if Templeton's attacks on him will kind of bring Warren back into the field a little bit on this. You know, as I said, it'll be certainly, I think Tuesday will be very interesting on the Republican side.
Will be a campaign blitz until then. You'll see it on the airwaves. You'll see it on signs. You'll see bus tours and campaigns and mailers and all that great stuff until next Tuesday, and then likely afterwards as well. So you can watch the full debates on SCTV's YouTube page. We'll have full transcripts up shortly on SCETV.org from those debates. And be sure to also check out all the Post and Courier's coverage from the debates, coverage this week, and, of course, up through the June 12th primary next Tuesday. Andy and Shauna, thank you again for joining me this week.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And don't forget to catch both of them on This Week in South Carolina on SCETV this Friday at 7:30 p.m. In our final section, Did You Know?, we focus on one quirky function of the state, politics, or government. It's named after the parliamentary procedure lawmakers use when speaking to each other. And we are joined with South Carolina Public Radio's Russ McKinney, who is back with some more state trivia. Russ, welcome back.
Thank you.
I have yet to answer any of these questions correctly, but my luck can change. I'm hopeful. And if not, I'm just going to delve into Walter Edgar's South Carolina, A History, that large book this summer, which Russ is cited in, we found out this morning several times. So
that's neither here nor there.
Very important person. Very intimidated. Anyway, Russ, fire away with your question this week.
Another easy one.
Because, he just keeps undercutting me.
So, you know, this should be a real no-brainer. The question is, did you know, which well-known city or town in South Carolina shares its name with a county in South Carolina? Same name. Yet it is not located in that county.
Oh.
So, for an example, if we were talking about the city of Darlington, it's obviously located in Darlington County. But what this question is, if, say, Darlington County, the city of Darlington was located in Marlborough County or Marion County. So which well-known city or town shares a name with a South Carolina county but is not located in that county?
Do you have choices here?
Yeah, we do.
Okay, because I was like thinking of a few. I'm like, there's a lot here.
And, again, real easy. A, Kershaw. B, Pickens. C, McCormick. D, Chesterfield.
I was thinking Chester and Chesterfield, so
that's tricky.
I'm going to go with Chesterfield.
The answer is A. Kershaw. In 1978, the town of Kershaw was annexed into neighboring Lancaster County. Of course, Camden is the county seat in Kershaw County. But Kershaw, which shared the name and the history and everything, in 1978, the voters in that town area of Kershaw voted to be annexed into Lancaster County.
Some more annexation talk. I see what you're getting there. Are there any other ones you want to enlighten us with, Russ?
None that I know of about the name situation. But if a listener knows of one, I hope they'll let us know. But this was in 1978 when Kershaw changed counties. But in 1975, the town of Edisto Beach moved from Charleston County to Colleton County. Mm. Now, almost all of Edisto Island remains in Charleston County, in unincorporated Charleston County. But the town, city of Edisto Beach, is actually located in Colleton County.
Hmm. Well, I apologize to our listeners in Kershaw and Chesterfield for not knowing their geography, per se. Russ, thanks again, and I like to maintain my losing streak here.
We'll get easier each time to try to get you there.
The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways SCETV wants to help keep you informed. Check out scetv.org for news, listen to the coverage from South Carolina Public Radio, and tune in to This Week in South Carolina every Friday night at 7:30 on SCETV stations. All of that, this podcast and more, is available on SCETV's super easy-to-use app and scpublicradio.org. Subscribe to us, and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find podcasts. You can also find us on the NPR One app. Follow us on Instagram at @SCLEDEPOD. That's at @SCLEDPOD. And you can see photos from the studio, around the statehouse, and on assignment, as well as our sweet memes. We're also on Twitter with the same handle, at @SCLEDPOD. Email questions, comments, or your gripes to scled@scetv.org. South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Post and Courier. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our supervising producer. Caitlin Park is our social media consultant. Tom Posey is our executive producer. This episode was recorded and produced in South Carolina Public Radio's studios here in Columbia on June 6, 2018. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening.
Secret message. It's bromide, bro.
Even gonna know what that means? I mean, I know it doesn't mean anything. That's the whole point of the secret message.